Different estimates are being circulated every other day on the potential number of mortgage holders who are using the current crisis to strategically default on their debt. The banks and some economic commentators would have us believe that the level of strategic arrears is significant. But what evidence is there to back up such a view? And does the debate on strategic debt dodging distract from the genuine hardship which so many mortgage holders are experiencing? I'm joined in studio by Vincent Martin of the group New Beginning, and on the line by Professor Gregory Connor of NUI Maynooth. But first, I want to talk to Gary Daly of Gary Daly and Company Solicitors, who represents many distressed mortgage holders. Gary, good morning to you.
Good morning, Miles.
Now, you represent commercial and private residential mortgage holders. What's your experience been of dealing with the banks? Is there a difference in the reception for commercial clients or as opposed to homeowners?
Miles, there's most definitely a difference. In relation to commercial deals, there are write-downs of millions of euro occurring. I deal a lot in the examinership area, and we've had clients over the last number of years who've had very good deals done with the banks, and I'm delighted for them. But in relation to residential borrowers, there is absolutely no write-downs being granted by the banks in relation to both unsecured and secured borrowings. You know, short-term loans and mortgages, the banks only want to really know about repayments, monthly repayments, and you know, the client's ability, the borrower's ability to repay.
Is this because banks are used to commercial failure and figure that the alternative in when they're dealing with a commercial client is bankruptcy or liquidation, in which case they might get nothing or next to nothing?
Yes, absolutely, and I suppose it's more acceptable at a sociological level that limited companies are allowed to fail and start again, whereas bankruptcy, certainly in Ireland, is seen as a moral failure, and I think it's incredibly unfair on people who are in very distressed situations. I had a client, for example, who had a very good profession during the good years, up until 2008, 2009. She was given 100% loan by a particular lending institution, but unfortunately, due to the property crash, she was involved in the property area. I can't give you too many details, obviously. She was unable to pay. Now her savings were used to repay monthly the borrowings to the bank, but eventually those savings ran out, and the bank sent an official to her house who stood in her living room and told her that he would take. At this stage, she was unable to draw the dole, as she had been self-employed. So he told her that when she eventually received her social welfare, her dole, that he would take that off her to make repayments to the bank. So she had better go to family members to borrow money to make repayments to the bank.
In your experience, when we hear this expression all the time, don't, if you are in arrears or if you are in trouble, don't keep your head in the sand. In your experience, is it the customer or is it the banks who have their heads in the sand?
There is no doubt certain clients of mine, due to unbelievably stressful circumstances, I see them sitting in front of me here every day, and you can see the physical deterioration in their every day that they're waking up. They're realizing that they have lost everything that they've worked for. So some people do deal with that by sticking their head in the sand. However, from our perspective, the most difficult issue dealing with is the intransigence of the banks. For example, when clients attend with us and say that, look, the only way to deal with this is to sell this property and at least get some money back for the bank, because we have both, a husband and wife, we've both lost our jobs, we're both on the dole, we have children at home, we're doing our best to make ends meet, we want to give some money back to the bank. So what we'll do is we'll sell the property. We send in an authority to release title deeds to the bank, and we recently got one back from the bank which asked the solicitor, i.e. me, to give an undertaking that the all the mortgage would be repaid to the bank. If I had signed that without reading it correctly, I would be on the hook for repaying the full amount to the bank if the negative equity had materialised by way of sale. But in any event, the issue with the banks is it goes to credit committee. When a purchaser comes along to the auctioneer and says, I'll pay 200 grand for this house, and the borrowings on the house are 400 grand. We draft contracts for the sale of the property. We contact the bank and we say to the bank, look, we have a purchaser here who are ready to sign contracts for the sale of this property at 200,000 euro. Can you make sure to give us an agreement in writing that you will provide a release of the mortgage so that we can sell the property? It can take up to 3, 4, or 5 months for the bank to make a decision at credit committee level to allow us to sell that property, during which time, obviously, the client has filled out their standard financial statement to deal with the negative equity issue. So there are two issues for the bank to consider, and it takes them months to consider it. Firstly is the purchase price of the property itself, and secondly, the client's proposal to deal with the negative equity, the remainder that's left after the purchase price is received. And we have found that, unfortunately, sales have fallen through, and these are good sale prices given the current economic environment. We have found that sales have fallen through because the banks have taken so long to come back.
And is it also your experience that most of the sales of, let's call them, distressed mortgages or distressed properties, that most of these sales are taking place not by private treaty, that the customer, the client, is not getting an opportunity to negotiate the best possible price they can? And obviously, they're not going to make any kind, they're not going to come out with any money, but at least reduce the level of negative equity.
Absolutely, Miles. And unfortunately, it is something that is, it seems to be the only scenario apart from pushing borrowers to repay monthly as much as they possibly can. The only alternative, and there is a list in the most recent Code of Conduct in Mortgage Arrears, there is a list of over 10 different resolution scenarios proposed by the Central Bank in dealing with mortgage arrears. However, the only scenario that we can see being presented to borrowers is for the voluntary surrender of the property. Now, we in this office have always been of the opinion, and I'm sure you would agree with this, Miles, that the best way to achieve a sale price is by way of private treaty sale. When a property goes on the market and the vendor is a receiver, or the vendor is the bank directly, that's a fire sale. The best price to be achieved is by way of private treaty sale.
Well, the bank has no interest. I mean, the obviously, if the customer himself, him or herself, is selling, he has some interest in getting the best possible price. The bank doesn't have any interest because essentially they are not writing down the total owed. It's still an asset on their books because their customer still owes them that amount of money, the negative equity, whatever it happens to be.
Absolutely, but there's no prospect in a lot of the cases of them receiving any more payment from the client in relation to the negative equity. The best way for them to make their money back, certainly in the short term, is to achieve the best possible price at sale point, which is by way of private treaty sale.
Why are they taking so long to make decisions? In the scenario that you outlined, where the property is being sold and you are going to them and saying, will you release the deeds? Why are they taking so long, given that, as I said, they're not actually writing down the total owed? That's still an asset on their books because their customer still owes the total sum.
Miles, I wish I could tell you why they're taking so long. It's an absolutely closed door system. They won't tell us what the criteria are. They won't tell us what they're looking for. We auctioneers are out there trying to get the best price for these people, and it is by far the best scenario to sell by way of private treaty sale, but they won't give any responses in writing in relation to either the proposal for the sale price or the proposal in relation to dealing with the negative equity. Nothing is put in writing. We get phone calls here from the banks and they will say either yes or no. But we have to insist, obviously, because, you know, a phone call is worth nothing to us. We have to insist when they do finally agree to sell the property that agreement is put in writing. Otherwise, we as the solicitor years that are left on the line.
And what's your position on this issue of strategic default, or what's your experience? And let me put it that way. You know, would there be a high percentage of your clients that you would be aware of, whether they admit it or whether they don't admit it, can actually pay but simply won't, refuse to?
Well, again, Miles, it's something I feel very strongly about. I think it's an absolute insult that the phrase strategic default is being used to describe certainly the clients that are attending in my office. As I mentioned earlier, I have seen clients in my office and they are literally in tears. They are people that are devastated. They've lost everything that they've worked for. People that have worked for 20, 30, 40 years. I had two clients in here, a married couple, who were given a mortgage of, I think it was €600,000, when they were 60. And these people are not strategic defaulters. These are people who are forced to make Hobson's choice. For example, if you have a married couple coming in and they have three children and the bank are every month demanding payment. However, those, you know, one of the kids gets sick and they have to make a payment to Crumlin Hospital. You know, what are they going to do? Pay the medical bill or pay a monthly payment to a bank that, in effect, and a lot of the times these people have lost their jobs, it's an interest-only payment. You know, this money is, all it is doing is servicing the capital. There's nothing being achieved by making the repayment. So while strategic default is, you know, I'm sure it does happen, it's certainly not in the vast majority of cases. I was at a meeting with AIB 2 weeks ago, and David Duffy, I asked him a question in relation to this. You know, his opinion was that there was 1 in 5 strategic defaulters out there. It is absolutely not my experience.
Okay, stay with us if you would, Gary, if you have time.
Because, I will indeed.
I suspect we'll be getting some questions in that you might actually be able to contribute to or help us with. But Professor Gregory Connor, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Professor of Finance at NUI Maynooth. Now, you believe the level of strategic arrears is significant. You would go along, I think, with David Duffy on this one. On what do you base that view?
Well, there isn't much evidence in Ireland. Brian Lucy of TCD has been desperately trying to generate some data. The data is held by the banks. The central bank has not pushed them to release it or itself try to analyze it. So I looked at the U.S. Data where there is evidence, and given Irish conditions, it looks to be in the range, maybe high 30s, could be 40%. 20 would be on the low end.
And this is based on figures in the United States of America.
Yes. Key things are the loan-to-value ratio is a key driver, as well as how difficult repossession is. On both of those criteria, Ireland would be way out in the sand states of the U.S. In terms of the likely level.
But obviously the situations are not comparable. Are figures, for example, in the U.S. not likely to be higher, strategic default figures, given that the customer can actually walk away? In Ireland, they will still be liable for unpaid capital and interest. And if they are strategically defaulting, that interest can be mounting at quite a considerable rate.
Perhaps, but there's other factors that go in the other direction. The difficulty of repossession over the last 5 years has been a strategic factor pushing many investors, especially BTL investors, to use the flaw in the law and basically take advantage of that flaw. So there are factors pointing in both directions. So I guess I agree with Brian Lucy. It's an awful shame that, you know, data has not been made available. We really only have kind of, I hear from banks and what they say, you know, very informally. We've had nothing from the central bank or the central bank working with the ESRI. And I agree with Gary Davies, you know, it's very emotional and you get down to an individual person and you don't want to say, oh, you know, you're actually a strategic defaulter. You don't want to say that to someone, especially if it's not true.
But
you know, economic statistics are not insults. They're just statistics. Mm. They're just numbers. It's like, is that today's temperature, it's probably, what is it out today? Probably 20. Is that an insult? It's just a number. So it's not really meant. You have to get used to that. You have people, and I think Gary Davies, you know, he deals with people, and then an economist kind of deals with aggregate numbers. They're different perspectives.
But just to stick with the different scenarios, the different templates, if you like, in the USA, if foreclosure is inevitable, if you're staring down the barrel of that particular gun, why would you bother paying the bank, knowing that you can walk away afterwards? In Ireland, the situation is slightly different. Foreclosure might be inevitable, but there is an incentive to continue to pay because you can't walk away afterwards.
Oh, and you're still liable for the arrears if you walk away in America. America does have, it's few states. It's only a few states that have that non-recourse feature.
So that's
a myth. It is true that in America, bankruptcy is much easier and much more acceptable than it has been in Ireland. So there are people who say, well, I might as well live my life for the next couple of years, spend the money in the normal way, and then I'll go bankrupt. So, yes, there is that possibility. But in Ireland, as you say, there are many factors that differentiate. I think the issue is not the driving issue. At the moment, if I may bring up another very sensitive issue, and I thought that was a good discussion a minute ago, but a very important sensitive issue now is legal fees. And we don't want the next stage, when we start facing up to this problem, that becoming very inefficient, enormous legal fees being generated. I understand what lawyers have to do, but if there are 150,000 properties that have to run through that very long, expensive process that was just described, that is going to bankrupt our banks. It's enormous possible cost. Now, it won't happen, but it's something that I think the legal profession has to face up to. This is not an opportunity to make an enormous, big, a generation of feeding frenzy for legal fees. It's just really not on. They have to be very careful that they don't abuse the current situation.
Just in relation to strategic default, what is a strategic defaulter? There is the cliche that the strategic defaulter is some kind of cynic who just decides, as you say, I'm going to enjoy the next couple of years before they come and get me. And that kind of a person is obviously loathed by the other cliche, which is the honourable mortgage payer next door who is putting themselves to the pin of their collar. Is it just the strategic defaulter in the main somebody who can pay but wants to keep the big car and send the kids to the fee-paying schools, or can pay but prefers to feed their family?
That is not a strategic default. Feeding family.
Well, it could be interpreted
not,
as it's somebody defaulter. Who has a certain amount of money available but chooses not to pay the bank, chooses to pay the supermarket.
Oh, gosh, no, that would not be. A strategic defaulter is someone who can reasonably pay, but for personal financial gain, short-term or permanent, chooses not to. So it certainly
You think that could be as high as 35% of people in arrears?
Yes. In the BTL sector, if you talk to the banks, Miles, and you probably interact even more than I do with these people, and they're shocked at what's going on in the BTL sector. So, yes, it got as high as 35% in the U.S. That was a peak number in the U.S. in March 2010. But it's surprisingly high. Keep in mind, this is 35% of the people in serious arrears. So keep in mind, 35% is only, it's like 0.75% or 1% of the Irish population. Because you have to put it through all of these percentages. It's the percentage of people in serious arrears, then that's the percentage of people who are mortgage holders. So it kind of shrinks the number. It isn't everyone you see walking. It isn't 35% of the people you see on the street.
Okay,
it's
so
of that small category.
We're talking, to some extent anyway, about the buy-to-let subset
of
all of this.
Vincent, very much. Let me, where it's really high.
Okay, let me bring in Vincent Martin of New Beginning. Your response to, in particular, what Gregory Connor is saying there.
Well, with respect to the professor, it's a nonsense. There is no evidence. In his own words, he said, there is not much evidence in Ireland. I'd like to know, is there any evidence whatsoever, and point me in the way of where it has been independently verified. His colleague, Professor Lucy of Trinity College, said there is no evidence whatsoever. So here we have, I think he's basing his opinion, it's premised on the United States of America, where he seems to wish to transpose and offer fireside opinions and shooting the breeze with us without any empirical evidence. about transposing legal, cultural and social climates from a completely different jurisdiction. It just doesn't make sense. And I would
agree. Does it not make sense, particularly in the buy-to-let category? In
no.
the home ownership category, the possibility is, the probability is that you're going to lose your home, your actual home. In the buy-to-let sector, you're not going to lose your home. You're going to lose something that was a business punt.
Again, we have no empirical evidence. And I have to be consistent here myself. My evidence, A New Beginning, it's anecdotal as well, but it's backed up by thousands upon thousands of mortgage holders. We're the largest organisation as such in this country. So we have that information behind us. But there's no forensic examination of panels of household budgets and incomes. There's no analysis, an independent analysis of questionnaires. What we have here is the banks. And I don't know if the professor has been around long enough in Ireland to know how people hold the banks. I don't know if he's been around long enough sharing his wisdom and world's experience in the world of academia to the that excellent college at Maynooth University. But I have to say this, that the banks, and I don't know if the professor is aware of this or not, they are not trusted. It's not that they don't put people, the customers first, they put people last. You heard solicitor Gary Daly say that. They have no vision. They're rudderless. They're not willing to help and be part of the Irish economic recovery. And they've been dragged kicking and screaming after 5.5 years to where we are now.
Okay.
So if they're going to be using and bandying around statistics, it's a cynical exercise. Jack O'Connor very excited at Glenty's summer school last week, where I believe there's an agenda at work here to soften up the Irish public, turn brother against brother, neighbour against neighbour, when they go
Vincent,
for the repossessions.
There may be an agenda, but as Gregory Connor pointed out, statistics are statistics. And
But there's none in this jurisdiction.
Okay, Gregory, I have to give you an opportunity to come back in there.
Yeah, there are some numbers. So, for instance, if you compare Northern Ireland, same culture, different repossession laws, with the Republic, the arrears rate in Northern Ireland is one quarter the arrears rate in the Republic of Ireland. That's one bit of news. The other is arrears since the clamp on repossessions in 2009, has absolutely exploded, completely out of historical context other countries. So that's coming from somewhere. Another thing is only a third of the people who are in arrears have any unemployment in their households. Two-thirds have no unemployment. So where is all the, there's something funny going on in the numbers. I agree. The central bank has not done the study that they could have done. It's very sensitive. I mean, you talk about strategic arrears, and Jack O'Connor says you're working for the Nazis. So, it's really...
That was an unfortunate comment, Professor. I don't associate myself with that. And I know I respect all academic opinion.
Well, but, he did say that.
Yeah, he did say that, but I'm not concurring with his remarks. But I am saying that we must substantiate an evidence base facts.
Statistics from Northern Ireland? Rates in Northern Ireland are a quarter of what they are here. That seems a very interesting statistic.
Well, first of all, up until very recently, the UK had a modern insolvency system. Now, we're only catching up and it's still not as good as the UK one. So it's not comparing like with like, because the UK system, what people can do voluntary arrangements, which are accepted by the lenders in over 94% of the cases. So there's massive movement. There's not this stagnation and paralysis. But to suggest that 35% of people in arrears are cynically defaulting and can pay and not paying and storing this money and heading off to the Galway races with it is offensive, actually.
Okay. Let me bring in Gary Daly just before we finish this particular segment. This is something briefly I want to talk to Vincent Martin about before we finish. Gary Daly, anecdotally, what about the buy-to-let sector? I don't know whether you've got many dealings with people in the buy-to-let sector, but do you think there might be a greater level of strategic default there?
It effectively, as far as we're concerned in this office, it comes down to the same thing as the ability to pay. Most people that have a buy-to-let also have their own family home. So they're trying to juggle two or three mortgages. They may have bought two buy-to-lets. But at the end of the day, it's all coming out of the same pot. The ability to repay is coming out of the same pot. So they have two banks banging on their door. One is a family home and one is a buy-to-let. But at the same time, they're dealing with two very aggressive institutions.
And just, Gary, thank you very much indeed for that, Gary Daly. We're going to have to leave that particular part of that segment of the conversation there. Gary Daly of Gary Daly Solicitors, and also Professor Gregory Connor, Professor of Finance at NU Imanu. Thank you both very much
for
joining us. Just before we go, you've hinted, Vincent, that New Beginning may evolve in the near future into a political party. Is that a possibility?
No, we said political movement, which
political
is quite
movement.
Distinct. But I'm uncomfortable.
Are you not a political movement already, no?
Well, we're going to formalise that, and we have agreed to initiate and facilitate a serious national dialogue. We have detected there's a lack of hope. The people are demoralised. They need to restore trust. Without hope, we are hopeless. And together with this, we need to do politics entirely different.
Are you talking about running candidates, though?
I've been asked that, and that's an instinctive response, which party politics, you know, as soon as one election is over, you go to the next election. That's not immediately on the agenda, because we're talking about a root and branch review of how politics is done in this country. The current government, and Brian Hayes candidly admitted at the Glenties Summer School, the government did not win by inspiring the people. They won by default due to the implosion of the only
default, perhaps?
Of the only other party. So there is now, you've Labour, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael all signed up to austerity. Where does Middle Ireland go? Where is the alternative voice? There is a need for radical reform and to do things entirely different.
Okay.
We'll keep very open-minded on this, and we're not ruling out anything, and we're not putting any preconditions on our national dialogue.
Vincent Martin of New Beginning, thank you very much indeed.